Welcome back to the Latino Newsletter podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zacarias, and our guest today, Juan Escalante, is a nationally recognized digital strategist and a leading voice in immigrant rights. A former DACA recipient, Juan is a fixture at state, local, and national advocacy campaigns. With over a decade of experience, his expertise and insights have been featured in premier outlets such as the New York Times, USA Today, Univision, and CNN, amplifying his influence in shaping national conversations on immigration policy. And of course, today we'll be talking about Venezuela. So who better to have on than Juan, who is a proud Venezuelan American. He arrived in the U.S. from Caracas at the age of 11, and he's currently residing in Los Angeles, California, where he continues to speak out in defense of immigrant rights. Thank you so much for being here, Juan.
Thanks for the invitation. It's nice to be on this side of the screen this time.
Well, let's get right into it. I know that you probably have a lot of thoughts and opinions on this matter, but I think we wanted to talk a little bit about some of your published work that you've written on the subject. And you mentioned in a most recent published article that you have an understanding of like the variety of perspectives and how they differ between Venezuelans who are still inside of Venezuela at the moment and those who might be living in the U.S. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a little bit of insight around that.
Yeah, of course. And thank you for that kind introduction. Yes, I've lived in the United States for the past 25 years, fled Venezuela upon the rise of Hugo Chavez, but I've kept in touch with my family for the years and have had a front row seat to a lot of the struggles that they have witnessed and experienced, largely due to food insecurity, lack of basic necessities like water, electricity, rolling blackouts. I mean, you name it. My family has also been targeted and in some instances even kidnapped by the high crime rate that cities like Caracas continue to experience. So I think, you know, as a well-rounded person in terms of having both, you know, an ear on the ground through my family back in Venezuela, but also being clear about what Congress is and isn't doing here, as well as the White House, I've been trying to kind of inform myself of those two very different perspectives to kind of, you know, put some added footnotes to a lot of the coverage that is continuing to pour out through mainstream media in the past couple of days, and then obviously in the days to come.
Yeah. And to that point, I think there are two big topics of conversation that I'm kind of seeing at the center front. And one of it being obviously like whether or not you were in favor of the elected leadership in Venezuela. There has been a lot of criticism about how U.S. sanctions have had a significant and measurable impact on the Venezuelan economy, obviously compounded with some internal management and governance. But would you say there is a clear distinction between what separates the effects of the U.S. sanctions versus what was already seemingly broken?
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that there's a compounded impact between the management and the sanctions, right? So like internal and external pressures have basically pummeled Venezuela into, you know, the collapse that it's currently experiencing. I'm actually writing about that for a piece out in Prism. And I think ultimately the type of economic mismanagement that the Chavez, later the Maduro administrations carried out with, you know, little to no help from anybody in the hemisphere that basically came into it being a situation where Venezuela found itself more and more isolated in the region and being pointed at by the United States as a rogue actor that decided that deserved to be punished and that somehow those economic sanctions were going to be a tool to coerce or push those regimes, Chavez and later Maduro, out of power. That didn't happen. And through those policy failures and lack of any sort of real solution at the local level, meaning free and fair elections or any sort of organized protest against the established governments, we're now in a situation where one of the most oil-rich nations in the world, right, doesn't have dedicated healthcare for its citizens, is suffering from hyperinflation, and it's put itself in a position where now what we're seeing is essentially the toppling of a strong man, but under the guise and direction of the United States, which for all intents and purposes is trying to push its new leadership, Delcy Rodriguez, the Maduro's vice president, into the direction that they wish her to go through. But that's just not sufficient in the terms of what is going to happen to Venezuela, the country, and its citizens in the short and long term of things.
Yeah, and I think to that point, there's a lot there, because regardless of whether you were in favor of elected leadership there or not, it seems like a majority of Venezuelans who are currently in Venezuela are feeling some kind of dissent or anger about the fact that their elected leader was essentially kidnapped and abducted by a U.S. force. And so I wonder if you can speak to that, because it feels like even when there's a moment of relief or celebration or whatever it is, there's also a lot of conflicted feelings about the U.S.'s involvement in that and their true intentions.
Yeah. I mean, look, for a lot of people, it's going to be hard-pressed to find Venezuelans outside of the country who are dissatisfied with the toppling of Nicolas Maduro, whichever way it may seem. Obviously, he still has a broad support base that is essentially protesting the way that the United States, captured him and his wife, Celia Flores. And those two realities are very much so, at odds, right? You have the celebrations that many people saw on TV throughout the world of Venezuelan communities, from the United States all the way down to Europe and beyond. But in between, it's also a very specific apparatus that is basically in place to clamp down on any sort of free opinion about what should or shouldn't happen to the government of Venezuela. The Washington Post posted a piece this week, and through their reporting, they're saying that there's a broader crackdown on any sort of speech that essentially talks well about Trump's operation, that talks bad about the current regime under Delcy Rodriguez, who is now the acting president of Venezuela. And I think through that, you can kind of see essentially that the opinions are divergent. I don't want to confuse that, the fact that like there's, no support for Maduro's regime, but within Venezuela. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember that the people who have expressed any sort of criticism live in fear. And if they so much as send out a message through WhatsApp or a meme, they could be arrested and prosecuted the same way that journalists continue to face all type of oppression in a country that, according to Mark Rubio and the Secretary Kristi Noem of the Homeland Security, say it's a lot freer today than it was yesterday. And I just find that very hard to believe, even with Nicolas Maduro out of power.
Yeah, I think this brings up this point about the U.S. media and the oversimplification of narratives that sometimes distort the reality of people's lived experiences in Venezuela. Would you say that there is, anything in terms of like the U.S. media and its coverage that it gets right about Venezuela?
I think oftentimes the ways in which we see the country of Venezuela is at extremes, right? It's either it's a country that's about is on the verge of collapse, or it's a country that is safe, according if you were to take Donald Trump at its word during its latest effort to run for the presidency. And for me, the truth ultimately lies with the people who are able to tell you that in order for them to buy a sack of flour to have in their homes, they have to wait in unimaginable lines or try to basically hunt it down like a treasure throughout a city. You also have to contend with the realities of essentially having to put together whatever resources you have to make it through another week and another month while prices continue to rise. So I think that, while mainstream media may try to essentially categorize a country in one way or another, the best way to essentially get to the center of things is to talk to Venezuelans about Venezuela, which has basically become my motto this week. Because there are so many things happening outside of just Caracas, which is the capital city, you know, Venezuela is a very diverse country that has anything from a chunk of the Andes mountain range all the way to plains and beyond, rural communities. And those people's stories and those people's voices are also missing from a lot of these type of conversations, either from lack of access, because Venezuela is not essentially, you know, welcoming reporters without a, you know, unbiased reporting without any sort of checks, from the current regime, or, those are the voices that are just not often accounted for. And I think that those are kind of like the underreported, pieces of this much broader story, right? What are the people in El Estado Bolívar, the south of Venezuela bordering Brazil, have to say about what's happening? And what do the rest of Venezuela as a whole have to essentially state about their future under what's going on between the United States and Delcy Rodriguez as a new head of state?
Yeah, I kind of want to bring it back to the United States for a bit because, you know, some of the things that you're mentioning sound like direct parallels of what's happening here even. You know, the censorship of media. And even now we're seeing the Trump administration rescind temporary protected status for Venezuelans who are living in the United States. And we also found out, obviously, that this Minneapolis woman, Renee Nicole Good, yeah, she's 37 years old, was shot and killed by an immigration officer. So for you, just kind of understanding the larger context around imperialism and militarization, do you see there being a direct correlation between the militarized violence and executive overreach abroad versus the presence of, say, like ICE and Border Patrol here in the United States?
You know, I think ultimately right now what we're seeing in the United States is essentially an administration that has no regard for people who are currently going through some of the most traumatic moments of their lives. So you're talking about essentially seeing a person, Nicolas Maduro, being toppled and essentially picked up by a military squad in the middle of the night and then sent to New York to face justice. But at the same time, you're sending a message that somehow the country is now fixed because this person, Nicolas Maduro, is no longer in charge. And as I mentioned before, I just couldn't be further from the truth. So, you know, those narratives are in conflict both here in the United States and also abroad, right? Here in the United States, you have Venezuelans being told that they won't be offered any type of asylum protections, any sort of temporary protective status, like you mentioned, which is essentially a type of immigration benefit that would allow people to remain in the United States until conditions are favorable in their home countries for them to return. That means either an economic collapse, political instability, natural disaster, so on and so forth. And it's within those contradictions, right, that I think that some of the parallels that you maybe that you're referencing are coming into focus, right? If you protest or speak out against immigration enforcement in the United States, you as an outlet may be discredited or disparaged, you know, by the White House or by the Trump administration. If you protest on the street, you're seeing essentially some of the aftermath and impact of what's happening, where citizens of the United States are taken to the streets and essentially saying that, you know, my neighbors are not going to be taken without any sort of due process. And you see anything from people being pepper sprayed in the face to unfortunately facing, you know, the other end of a gun, which is what happened in Minnesota, where this woman tragically was shot and killed by a federal officer. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, if you speak ill about the government, same thing, right? You're basically taking into custody, and this is a place that doesn't have regards for any sort of type of human rights. So you may just be disappeared without any sort of communication with your family in Venezuela. So I think it's concerning, right? It's certainly concerning, you know, when you put one thing next to the other and you see how these things play out. What I'm hopeful right now is, you know, hoping that Congress, to some degree or another, asserts the authority and hopefully has a seat at the table within this continued talk about the future of Venezuela, mostly because the people, and specifically talking about the United States, mostly because the people here in the United States are afraid of going back and facing the regime that Nicolas Maduro basically set up, and the United States chose to leave there in place. Characters like Delcy Rodriguez, Diosdado Cabello are not unfamiliar players of persecution and oppression. So while those people remain in power, there should be a conscientious play to say what essentially is going to happen to the people of the United States who are from Venezuela, and is it safe for them to even pretend to go back?
Yeah, and I think this speaks to kind of a larger point about like what defines safety and what the intentions were kind of going in there, right? Because this immigration enforcement policy that we have in this country directly undermine the claims of solidarity that solidarity and liberation that Trump's administration is preaching about Venezuelans and like their country. So we're seeing this juxtaposition. And I think that the elephant in the room here being that Venezuelan oil is a valuable resource. And so a lot of people are already speculating that it's going to be central to Trump's administration strategy moving forward. So I'm wondering, how do you see that playing out in the next several weeks or months?
You know, I was talking to a couple of colleagues today about everything happening, you know, regarding Venezuelans in the United States. And my words were basically, you know, Marco Rubio should know better, right? And the obvious thing here is that that is just not the case. Even if he knew better, the Trump White House is basically making it very clear that they're going to talk oil first, human rights, democracy, people, whenever we get to it, if we get to it. And again, coming back to like domestic policy here in the United States, that should give a lot of pause, right? To the people here in the United States who are worried about their Venezuelan friends and neighbors. That should give concern to elected officials, right? About essentially how we're going to be, what the expectation is from Venezuela if we're continuing down this path, right? And we're going to somehow micro macro manage, you know, Delcy Rodriguez's government out there, and ultimately what's going to happen to the people both in Venezuela that we claim to have liberated, and what does it say for about our country, right? If we're going to be deporting these people back to the same oppression that they fled from just under a rebrand and a different head of state, I think that those are very valid questions that really deserve real answers and not just, you know, a secondary thought. Because if we're talking and if we're, you know, I say this kind of like in the air quotes type of deal, if we're being sincere as a country that we want to help our neighbor, that we want to talk about this hemisphere and protections and, you know, everything that, you know, is being parroted on late night TV, you know, from people in Washington, D.C., then we also have to center the people of that country, whether they are exiled or whether they're still back there hoping, praying, right, that the United States is actually going to follow through and help them, you know, get out from underneath the impact of the Maduro regime.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you make a lot of good points, but I will push back a little bit and say that there seems to be so much valid skepticism based on the U.S.'s history of, I guess, imperialism or executive overreach, and especially now in this administration, where we've seen throughout history, U.S. has had intervention in places outside of Venezuela, right? Like Chile, Guatemala, Panama, Nicaragua. So just understanding the context of all of that, there seems to be a lot of fear and uncertainty around what role the U.S. should play, if any, outside of the United States. And, you know, even as far as looking at the legal process for this, it seemed like Trump went, you know, out of his way to essentially go through without congressional approval, without any direct threat of war, essentially reviving the Monroe Doctrine. So we're seeing an administration that is being really conniving and strategic in the way that they're implementing some of these like political moves. And I'm wondering for you, as someone who has like personal ties to the region and also has like a larger understanding of the historical and political context, do you feel like Venezuela has the structure, the communal support to really take the reins and rebuild after something like this?
You know, just to kind of clarify, the United States as a whole does not have a record of doing good when it intervenes in foreign affairs, right? So I think that, you know, that's a really big exclamation point when it comes down to everything that's happening here. But I think, you know, your question about whether or not Venezuela as a whole has the ability, you know, to come out and essentially regain itself, you know, from everything that has transpired over the past 25 years. I think that the determination is there. I think that there's a willingness, even from the people who have fled and made lives and moved to other countries to help, right, their families, their friends, you know, back home, see a better future and build a better country for generations to come. Unfortunately, that's all going to depend as to whether or not those people are taking into account and are given the self-determination that they should be given, right? We saw an election just in 2024 where Maria Corina Machado basically ran her own campaign. Later, it came under El Mundo and was able to kind of bring out receipts and said, you know, this is essentially the machinery that is operating here within Venezuela that is, you know, either rigging elections or maintaining the status quo. And, you know, if we're going to talk about, you know, how we present those type of arguments while simultaneously praising those people, right? There's no shortage of Republicans in Florida right now praising Maria Corina Machado and saying that they wish her to be the president of Venezuela eventually down the road. But if we're going to talk that talk and we're going to just at the same time just thumb our nose and say, no, but we rather deal with these people because they know where the oil is and where the money is and everything else, then, you know, we have to ask our questions. Why is it that we're not uprooting the entire system from one go? Why is it that, you know, the United States has to essentially threaten Venezuela with a second strike? Why is it that the Trump administration has to say something like they may be boots on the ground when they know, just as you mentioned, Michelle, that they didn't get a congressional approval the first time? Now that Congress is back in session, I don't think that they're going to get congressional approval for any other time, because now the spotlight is on the White House, right? And I think that for the listeners who are kind of like not following some of the quote unquote insider baseball here, Congress is the body in the United States that has the authority to declare war. The president may be the chief in command when it comes down to the armed forces, but ultimately there needs to be some level of accountability here. What we have seen so far is an administration from the executive branch just acting as if this were just another day under the sun, and that they're just doing this out of the kindness of their heart, but at the same time saying, we're going to prioritize oil and everything else will just come second because it's all about national security and the people. Well, they have a freer country today than they had before. And those are two very different things that are hard to reconcile for anybody who's listening.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. You've given us a lot to think about, so I appreciate you for being on and for sharing your perspective with us. And I also know that this is a deeply personal issue to you, so you know, I appreciate you being able to contextualize it and also personalize the stories of people who are most directly impacted by this.
My opinion is one of many out there when it comes to the Venezuelan community inside and outside Venezuela. So I'll just repeat what I said earlier in the show. If you want to talk about Venezuela, talk to Venezuelans. Not just talk to one, talk to many. Because the truth of the matter is that the future of Venezuela will be shaped by the people of Venezuela inside and outside their country. Or it should, at least. Those people should be taken into consideration when we talk about these subjects. So I encourage everybody to essentially take what I'm saying and apply it, right? Look for Venezuelans that you may disagree with, who may disagree with each other. And between that web of differing opinions is where you'll be able to really put and weave in together all of these different types of narratives that we'll continue to see. And, you know, I'm appreciative to you for, you know, for the interview and for the space. Ultimately, I feel that this is a story that we're going to come back to. And, you know, I'd be happy to come back whenever you guys will have me.
And that's a wrap on the Latino Newsletter podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zacarias. Today, we'd like to take a second to acknowledge Renee Nicole Good, the 37-year-old woman who lived in Minneapolis and legal observer who was shot and killed by immigration enforcement today. She is the first documented U.S. citizen that had been killed by immigration enforcement officers. She was a mother and a partner.
This episode of the Latino Newsletter podcast was produced by Joaquin Kotler, Juan Diego Ramirez, and Michelle Zacarias. It was edited by Julio Ricardo Varela. Music by a cast of characters via Soundstripe. Season 2 of the Latino Newsletter podcast was made possible through individual donations and the Latino Media Consortium. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and hosts and don't necessarily reflect those of the Latino Newsletter or its staff.